Good morning. Again. I'm Nell Newton, and I'm your lay leader this morning. Welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. We are an intentionally inclusive congregation, and we welcome everyone to our church. And we wish to extend a special hospitality to those of you who are guests with us today. And if you'd like to learn more about our church, please visit the welcome table out in the foyer. Our opening words are the mission statement. Please join with me in affirming our mission statement, printed in your order of service and on the wall above our windows. At First UU Church of Austin, we gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice. This morning's reading is from a book, Generation to Generation, by Rabbi Edwin Friedman. It's about change, paradox, and playfulness. The capacity for religious leaders to be paradoxical, challenging rather than saving, earthy, sometimes crazy, and even devilish, often can do more to loosen knots in a congregational relationship system than the most well-meaning, serious efforts. Again, this is not because being paradoxical affects the contents in the heads of the others, reverse psychology, but because the act of being playful frees others by forcing them out of their serious games. Taking the other side. A rabbi came into his Sunday school one morning to find teachers, parents, and the religious school principal terribly upset by the fact that a mischievous 11-year-old had transliterated the well-known Anglo-Saxon word for feces into its equivalent Hebrew phonetics. There was to be an important celebration that day, and it was clear that the wrong tone had been set from the beginning. Instead of entering the discussion going on about the psychological and religious import of the child's action, the rabbi noticed that the child had spelled the word mistakenly, and using the long vowel instead of the short one. The rabbi ignored the content of the situation and berated the child for not paying more attention to the phonetic details, and then told him that he could only join in the festivities after he had spelled it right 100 times. Process superseded content, and celebration carried the day.
Now, this is my fourth sermon on the subject of change just since the beginning of January. Now, I know this is going to get some people beginning to talk, such as, well, maybe the guy is running out of subjects to talk about. Maybe he's running out of sermon material, and all he knows to do is talk about change. Well, I am talking about change again because I wanted to share a different perspective than I have done so far. And because, as the interim minister of this congregation, I am immersed in change daily, if not weekly, and wished to share some of the excitement of that with you. Change is a part of life. It is inevitable. It occurs without our volition and our permission. And yet, there is another force at work in the world, balancing the forces of change, which is the force of homeostasis, of preservation of what is. With the feeling that life is threatened by change. And, factually speaking, we know that not all change is good. Not all change leads to health. But to be sure, these two dynamics, the nature of change, the reality of change, and the tendency towards homeostasis are at work and sometimes at war within our lives. It is a fact that life is meant to be a process toward a destination. If life does not move forward, if life isn't going somewhere, whether that is on the level of the individual or a relationship or a congregation, then negative things can happen. We see the innate power of the human drive for change breaking out across the world, particularly the Middle East and North Africa, right before our eyes. Since December of 2010, Algeria, Bahrain, Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Libya, and Yemen have all seen major protests break out all over their countries in the face of a very threatening set of consequences to such rebellion. Corruption, dictatorship, human rights violation, unemployment, severe poverty, the cost of food, and other things have been associated with these changes. We don't know all of the causes, which also include a large percentage of youth in the population. But we know that at the core, there is the power of the human desire to move toward greater life, to move towards something better, to move towards a greater fulfillment. And what we see happening all over the world is true on the level of the individual and the congregation. This feeling of moving towards something that's meaningful, a feeling that one is a part of some great thrust towards a better world, a more humane world, a improved world, can be very powerful. About 9 years ago, I took my first trip to China. And I talked to many people there. And you could sense an excitement about many people, especially students in China, who knew that their country was moving in a new direction, in a different direction, and that their lives would be impacted. And there was a tremendous excitement in their hearts because of that. Now, this church, as I mentioned, is also involved in a time of change. And there are several questions that must be answered as any institution or group moves towards change. The first is, where are we going and how are we going to get there? Now, this church has already answered those questions because you've created a mission statement, you've created a set of ends or goals, and you have begun to institute policy-based governance, which is the way in which you will organize yourself to go towards those goals. But there is a second issue. And it is the second issue that is all important as this congregation moves through the next 2 years. And this second issue is, when you start moving towards change, how will you navigate the forces of homeostasis vis-a-vis the forces of change? Now, this is where things get a little complicated. I knew a minister who, through his charismatic enthusiasm and his brilliance as an organizational leader, led the church he was a minister of to ever and ever higher levels of development, church growth, membership attendance, levels of giving, spectacular worship services. Then after 5 years of great achievement, the church leaders mutinied and he was cast into the outer darkness. He was brilliant at understanding change and at how change should occur. But there was something about the system and its desire for homeostasis that was riddled with anxiety at what was happening and struck out against the movement towards change. I know of another situation where a church in the Southeast had grown to over 800 members. The minister became somewhat frayed by the pace of change. She left, and within 18 months, the church returned to its original size of 300 people. Change happened, but at the very first opportunity, the system and its drive towards homeostasis snapped back. And we see this dynamic between the forces of change and homeostasis being played out on a grand stage with our national politics. President Obama ran on a theme of hope and change. He was and is one of the most intellectual and shrewd presidents this nation has ever had. And he writes so beautifully as well. Surely, one thought, he could bring about the change which he himself so brilliantly articulated. When President Obama was elected, I, like many others, thought this society had made a great leap forward towards a more progressive land. And when I watched, along with my wife and two children, President Obama at his inauguration, I am not ashamed to say that I shed a few tears, thinking that the great, decent heart of this country had risen and a new spirit moved over the land. But now, lo, these 2 years or so into his presidency, I asked with many others, what happened to the change? What happened to the hope? The corporation dominated society before him is ever more intact and strengthened and powerful now. And this struggle around the health care debate is an illustration between these forces of change and no change, change and homeostasis. The health care bill was passed, but there have been serious attempts still pending to negate this passage, to bring back the homeostasis that was before them. Let's look at this process a little more carefully. Rabbi Edwin Friedman was a mentor of mine. He lived and worked in Washington, D.C. He was a rabbi who had served in congregations. He became a practicing therapist. He worked for a while in the Kennedy administration. He was right in the heart of the political world of Washington, D.C., and he saw three systems at work, all in one glance, as it were, from where he lived and worked. The system of politics, the system of religion, and the system of therapy and psychology. And as he studied systems theory and watched change happening and not happening in these spheres of influence around him, he began to notice that as people begin to get more serious about trying to change others, the less change actually happens. He began to see that the harder people try to change other people, the more people trying to be changed dig in their heels and resist change. He began to see the more serious and less playful people became about change, the less change actually happened. He began to see that a person may succeed, either in their family or in their congregation or their institution, to bring about change. But if the process of doing it wasn't done correctly, and if the forces of change and the forces of homeostasis weren't held in balance, the system would snap back. He began to see very clearly that seriousness and willfulness prevent change. He began to see that playfulness is an antidote to seriousness, and he began to see that paradox is an antidote to willfulness. He began to practice this in his therapeutic work. And here's an example, an illustration of the consequence of that. He was counseling a woman whose husband was having a struggle with alcohol. This woman came home every day from work and found herself facing a husband who was having a struggle with alcohol. Her anxiety increased. She tried to lecture him, berate him, tell him the virtues of sobriety, and warned him again and again. She sought in every way she knew to change him. Then she was coached by Friedman, and she began to shift the course of how she was going to act and react to her husband. And here is one of the consequences of that change. She came home one day, and she said this, "Honey, I've been thinking things over, and I have decided that you have a right to drink all you want, to enjoy life to the hilt, and to risk it. After all, it's your life. I would like to stop nagging you also, but I've got a problem. It's fairly clear to me that you probably won't make it much longer. And I don't want to be stuck with the mortgage and the car payment, much less being a single parent. So I'll make an agreement with you. If you will agree to triple your life insurance, I will agree never to mention your drinking again." He began to apply this in his therapeutic practice, and he also began to apply it to ministers and rabbis, because he was developing a practice with them and with congregational systems. A minister came to him in great distress, saying that the giving levels were down, the pledges levels were down, and she was very frustrated and upset by this, and what could she do? He coached her and encouraged her to follow a course of action she would have never thought of. She called a meeting of all the leaders of the church, and being as calm and as authentic as she possibly could be, she said to them, "I just want you to know that our collections have been so low, it has gotten to the point that we probably won't last through the end of the year. Therefore, it would be my suggestion that we establish a committee to see if we can still get a good price for our building and merge with our rival across town." He began to realize that he had inhabited a world in which he had been encouraged to think of ever creative ways to get certain people fixed and improved. He began to realize that he had been trained and convinced that he should be a good therapist and a good rabbi by getting people to do something that he, as the authority, knew they should. But he began to realize that life is much more complicated than that. And that one needed to find a way to tap into the wisdom and strength of everyone. And out of this experience and many others, Friedman developed an understanding of leadership, which, in his opinion, had the best chance of fostering and nurturing change. And this was true whether one spoke of a family, an extended family, a nuclear family, a congregation, a political system, a business, or any other group of persons. And he came to the conclusion that it is very important for any group of people to develop a culture of understanding the nature of how change happens in systems. And it was through what he called self-differentiated leadership. And this way of leading, this way of creating leaders and thinking about leaders in any system, had the following characteristics. One, it involved realizing that for every leader, whether it be in a family or a congregation or a political system, there is a trap that awaits all leaders. And this trap is that the leader will begin to think that he or she knows what is best for other people, and that without that guidance, the people could not do the right thing. And what happens in many, many marriages and in many congregations and in many systems is somebody develops the notion that they know the best way for the system to go, for the relationship to go, and if they can succeed in convincing the other person, everything will be great. Therapists do that, ministers do that, rabbis do that, priests do that, heads of families do that, heads of political organizations do that. And the trap that creates is that the more the leader tries to fix and improve, the more the husband tries to improve or fix the wife or vice versa, the more the leader tries to make better the other person, the more the other person digs in their heels and change in any meaningful way stops. So there has to be a way of understanding leadership that transcends that dichotomy in some way. Secondly, leadership that is effective must understand the power of sabotage. Rabbi Friedman said that every time a person comes into a counseling session, they always ask for help. I want help in some way, and then they define the problem. But there is, Rabbi Friedman said, an unspoken assertion that the person also makes, and that is this. They don't articulate it, but it's there. It is this: I want help, I want guidance, but I will do everything I can to prevent you from succeeding. To know the power of sabotage and to be realistic about it is a very important thing. Now, a summary of the characteristics of the leader, as Friedman defined it, that helps a system move towards real change is the following. Leaders in a system that want change must be focused and centered on what is the greatest good for the greatest numbers and look constantly for how one's personal biases may be influencing that and coloring that and do everything they can to get rid of their personal preferences, their personal biases, and as a leader, be centered in what truly is the greatest good for this group. People can sense that about leaders. The second thing is to develop and to take very clear, very clearly conceived, and very carefully defined positions about what is important for the organization. The third characteristic is to take full responsibility for one's words and actions, and to never blame others for what we do and feel and think. Blaming others is a poison which will toxify any emotional system that it occurs in. Fourthly, stay in touch with and stay emotionally connected to everyone in the system, particularly those who disagree with one's own position. Deal with sabotage and the loyal opposition by neither becoming reactive to or giving into the pressure they exert, but staying true to the course. 7. And this is the difficult one for all leaders, and this is what makes leadership particularly paradoxical. It is to let go of outcome, to let go of who gets credit, to let go of control of anything or anybody, to let go of trying to change people, and constantly focus on changing oneself. This is the paradox at the heart of leadership and the peace without which it cannot survive. As often as possible, a key part of leadership is to delegate leadership to others. Will leadership through self-differentiation always work? No, it will not. It cannot be guaranteed to work better than consensus or charisma. But the real question is, what does it mean to work? For if change is to be meaningful, it's got to take place in a system in which everybody feels free to assent to and embrace the common good, and not to get there by coercion or manipulation. This congregation has taken a tremendous leap forward in creating a mission, in creating policy governance, in creating a clear set of ends, and in other ways, this congregation, in ways I don't think it fully appreciates, has made a great leap forward. But now, a significant challenge awaits you as you look towards the next year, 2 and 3 years. It is so important for a church to develop a culture of self-differentiated leadership so that the changes that are so important to you can truly thrive. I wish for you great prosperity, great success, great thriving as you walk this way ahead of you. I look forward to being of service to you as you take this next leg of your journey. I share with you this benediction. May the strength of our Mother, the Earth, and the peace of still deep waters, and a compassion embracing all persons, leaving no one out, be in us and between us until we gather again in this sacred home of hope. Amen.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.